Hello and welcome to Presenting, a podcast where we chat about various topics related to role-playing games, typically Paizo products such as Pathfinder and Starfinder, but also others. I'm John Godek, and with me today is Paul Fields. Welcome to the podcast.
Hey, John.
So, Paul is a third-party publisher running Evil Robot Games. Prior to that, Paul took up fencing in college. He killed Richard III on stage. Hopefully that's not for real. Like a play, I'm guessing, right?
Yeah.
He drew telephone poles for fun at the local Ren Fair, and he studied graphic arts and architecture. So, Paul, I'm not sure how any of this kind of fits, but how did you get started with Evil Robot Games? Can you tell us about the company and kind of what led you to starting that up?
Well, oddly enough, I was working a lot of overtime as a contractor doing IT consulting. And I'd been a gamer since the early 80s and loved science fiction, loved fantasy, loved all the genres. And I had an idea for kind of a setting, kind of a campaign. And I thought that I would start working on the story Bible for something that at the time I thought was going to be a mishmash of D20 Modern from Wizards, mm-hmm. and Paizo's Pathfinder fantasy rules that mm-hmm. Had kind of improved on the 3.5 skeleton. And so I started getting concept art and things built for this setting that I was outlining for a science fiction galaxy, actually using the Milky Way galaxy, but I started putting these things together. I started putting together a core rule book by 2012. I started doing some, playtesting with, mm-hmm. with that set of, again, D20 Modern, D20 Future, and some Pathfinder improvements, and got some feedback on the playtests and things went well. But I started, continued to keep just slow rolling this, collecting the concept art and building up a setting Bible and things of that nature. And then Paizo announced they were going to come out with Starfinder, which was a science fiction fantasy version of the Pathfinder rules. And I said, well, that makes my job a whole lot easier. If a big game company is going to write all the rules and all I've got to do is develop the setting material and it'll all be under the OGL and I can do that, but I still hadn't published anything. I'd been playing for years and try to balance things as a GM and as a player, and read a lot of FAQs and Q&A things that the publishers would put out and look at the errata and try and see what they fixed and why something they would fix later was originally broken and get into that stuff. And I had always been, trying to publish this eventually. It was a goal, since I had playtested in a couple of a friend of mine's games that he had, published and started helping another friend of mine look at and edit his, manuscripts for things he wanted to release. So
you've been working on this a long time,
yes.
The company and or the idea, and you were collecting, which is arguably one of the most expensive parts, is the artwork. That's the artwork and the cartography. That's like some of the hardest stuff to do, the most expensive stuff. And you were doing that even before you had the whole game outlined, it sounds like.
Yes. So you'll find out, and I admit this publicly and tell people, this is not the way to do it. I started from the world-building side, and as sometimes you see the meme that says you can't just keep world-building, eventually you have to publish the book or you have to run the game. You mm-hmm. can't just world-build. But that's where I started. I started on the art side, doing the concept art and kind of putting down my story notes and ideas and things. And that's an expensive way to start. And if I was a scrappy little publisher out there, what I would do is I would design the smallest thing, a couple of feats, a character, one spaceship, something that I could draw a box around and say, this is what a finished published product is going to look like. Decide that if that has a word count, you know, couple of pages, couple of thousand words, if it needs one piece of cover art or piece of stock art I can use, what is a total, what the business guys call the minimum viable product. You start with that. It has a start point. It has an end point. It has a budget. And you work your way through that. You put it out. You ask your friends to tell you what they think of it. Do they love it? Do they hate it? You try to get it out there. And then you work on your second one. And you learn from the first one where you could have saved money, where you should have spent more money. That's how you start. If you're starting out and you really need to learn from that. No, I started with thousands of dollars in world building first. And it's really fun because you take an idea and you send it to an artist and they send you back some sketches and you, ooh, this is exciting. And it's kind of like what I wanted in my head. And you get involved in the process and it snowballs and you give the artist some money and they can, you know, eat food or pay rent or whatever. And that part's good. But then you still don't have a product. You have a piece of a slice of a universe. And it's addicting. I've talked to other folks at other publishing companies that have the same thing. Getting art back is fantastic. It feels really good. It's a very expensive, addicting hobby. You have to actually make a paying part of your business.
Yeah, I saw you had recently some cyberpunk concept art posted up online. That was awesome. I was amazed at how good that was.
Yes. Mika is a fantastic artist, founder in the D&D Fantasy Art Facebook group. And she had an Ask Me Anything session going on. And so I said, do you ever do anything science fiction? And being that I found her in the D&D fantasy art, she said, no, people always pay me to do fantasy work. And I said, well, you know, would you ever do something in the cyberpunk science fiction genre? And she said, sure, I love it. Nobody just pays me for it. So we started talking about what that would look like. And what about the project, which is Jim's cyberpunk game. Jim is one of my collaborators. And he wanted this. The idea is you've got a gal. She's out at a fancy event in a nice hotel. And she's got a glass of wine. And she's enjoying herself. And then someone breaks down the door. And she drops the glass of wine and starts to turn. And the fancy dress turns into a suit of body armor because it's all built out of nanotech. And she grabs out of her little purse her you know, futuristic gun and points it at the bad guy. And so you've got a starting point at the evening gown. You've got the middle point where things are starting to turn. And then you've got this end point where she's wearing the full suit of body armor and she's returning fire on the bad guys. And the artist says, that's a lot of work. She says, that sounds like it's sequential art, like a comic book. It's three panels or something. And we had always kind of decided that we thought it would be, you know, a nice starting point and a nice ending point and wanted to try to present it all in maybe a two-page spread. And she said, what if I give you something in the middle? And I said, well, you know, let's run with it. So she starts sending me sketches and we talk back and forth and we end up with this piece where the dress is starting to tear apart for the little nanotech pieces and starting to reform these combat boots and shooting gloves she's got on and other things. And she's kind of crouched down and shooting at the camera. And there's little nanoparticles flying everywhere around her. So yeah, that was fun as an art director. Sometimes it's a little challenging to get the person to know what you want. And every time I named an anime, a manga, anything of that nature in the genre, she's like, yeah, no, totally. And she'd want to go with something very, very holographic because I mentioned Ghost in the Shell. So, I mean, she's right there with me in the idea, but she's seeing one thing and I'm seeing another thing. What you got is mostly her vision. And so it was something Jim and I had been talking about. How do we do it? How do we get it there? Now he wants that to be the cover of the technology chapter for the book.
Nice.
So
So you've been collecting this art and building your world. But Evil Robot Games has only been around like around 5 years now.
So we've published our first books in 2017 for mm-hmm. Pathfinder and Starfinder. Mm-hmm. I've had the URL longer than that. The website's been up longer than that. But we really started publishing when James Sutter was still over mm-hmm. Starfinder at Paizo, and they had released the Starfinder compatibility license and said, mm-hmm. if you want to get in on the Starfinder early release stuff, you've got to be an established publisher. Mm-hmm. I wasn't.
Yes.
So we pushed out a book for Pathfinder that was our gear guide using the Iron Gods mm-hmm. technology rules and tried to make something that fit Pathfinder that had some of the art and work that we had already done. And James had left Paizo. Mm-hmm. By the time this was out, Owen was sort of over a lot of things at the Starfinder desk at the time, but he wasn't in the you can be in or not be in the licensing program at the time. So Gen Con of 2017 came, and as a subscriber, I got my Starfinder books at the Paizo booth and got the PDFs, and in my hotel room started in InDesign finishing some stat blocks and other things for some starships that had been designed and were part of the universe. Mm-hmm. And so I have these two fighters, and Owen really like the heavy fighter that we had. It looks kind of like an X-wing with big long wings and a big gun. If you combine an X-wing and an A-10, you kind of get something that looks like our heavy fighter.
Okay.
And so we put that out from the hotel room up to our drive-through account and released that during the week of Gen Con. And sometimes you'll hear Owen say that, you know, Evil Robot had something out like day one of release.
Yeah.
But I had to do that as a Paizo subscriber with my books with me and my PDF downloaded from the website as a subscriber. Not that I had any special pre-release access, because I, you know, hadn't had enough of a publishing track record to get into the pre-release program for Starfinder. Mm-hmm. 2 years later, when Pathfinder 2 had a pre-release program, we did have a track record. We did get that early access, and we're able to have a campaign setting ready for Pathfinder 2 on the day that it launched, all mm-hmm. thanks to Paizo putting out a font of icons that lets us make the special reactions and actions,
right.
All of that stuff, and, you know, the compatibility license and the little logo and all that. So that was nice to have something out at launch and in front of all the, you know, sort of hungry eyeballs. They're like, yeah, we've got a core book. What are we going to do with it? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so,
so with those early releases like that you had, you know, your early starships and then the early campaign, because they were right at release time, did they have pretty good success?
I want to say that the early starships might have sold, you know, 50 copies, which is a good benchmark, mm-hmm. but I mean, like in the first week, which is kind of unbelievable. Mm-hmm. Usually you'll get a couple, you get a dozen, you depend on how big your audience is, but for a tiny little publisher like us with very few titles at the time, very few sales at the time, 50 in a week was fantastic. And there was I put up some of my sales numbers on one of my web pages as a comparison, and there's a bump you can tell when Owen mentioned us in social media that we had a spike in sales directly after that. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, okay. I can see we were doing okay. We were doing okay. Oh, somebody mentioned us. And then they kept on going on from there. So it's probably a silver title on drive-thru mm-hmm. now.
Wow, that's pretty good. Yeah.
Right. Right. But very, very early on, it was very quick to hit copper that year and then go on from there. So, but we kept on turning out spaceships. And the reason we kept on turning out spaceships is, I don't know how much you remember, the early Starfinder days, if you wanted an alien, there were a million people in the forums that will tell you, oh, go to your Pathfinder bestiary, pull it out, reskin the creature, call it a Starfinder creature, and give it an energy armor class. Mm-hmm. Well, there's 5 bestiaries, 6 bestiaries for Pathfinder 1. There are no starships in Pathfinder for people to reskin. There aren't tons of aliens, you know, elves and other species of creatures in the bestiary that you can just reskin and call them an alien. So the starships became our bread and butter because it was the one thing people weren't making a lot of on their own. And I already had some deck plans done by Keith Curtis. He's one of the cartographers that we work with a lot. And he did a lot of our Space Elf, the Eldred faction in the game. He did all of the deck plans for those. And so those were out, and we had some other ones that we started adding on to. And so I pulled in Matt Frankella, who, like I said, he and I did some of the one piece for Grimmer Space, and he's been doing a lot of my more recent stuff. So Matt's been doing Wild West and Victorian England things for me, and Keith is doing a, if you remember, there's a real karst pillar national park in China that was the inspiration for the floating mountains in Avatar. We designed a valley kind of like that for an airship campaign I'm working on, where I want people to be able to race between the columns and along a, you know, little river going through a valley. And so we've been using Keith for some pieces and Matt for some other pieces. And so building up, again, more of the deck plans and maps and all of that stuff that has slowly been accumulating really became key to people when COVID hit, to have a map. So we started converting a lot of our existing map materials, 300 DPI ready for print and publication, over to 70 DPI so they could put them up on Roll20 and get around those ships and play with those. So we have those ships. And again, people might have dungeons. People might have monsters. People didn't have a bunch of spaceships just laying around. Some people would borrow stuff they had from Traveler Games. Some people would reuse a lot of Star Wars stuff that they found on Pinterest or whatever, but there weren't a lot of dedicated, made specifically for Starfinder maps available. And the ones that were coming out from Paizo, maybe you get a flip mat a month, was kind of slow. Not, I mean, it's still a fantastic pace, but for a new game, there was a void there for your third-party publishers to step into.
Yeah, and they haven't done a lot of starships. I mean, that's been pretty limited. Even with the release of all the new starships and Starship Operations Manual, they introduced lots of starships, but not the deck plans for them.
Right. And so the flip mats cautiously and slowly caught up with that. There's a thing that I've run into with your starships is that there's a size limit. And the size limit, I want to say, is that a large ship, you get to 150 to 300 foot to a huge, large or huge ship, and people start running out of dinner table. So Matt and I have a 350-foot two-deck frigate. It is the largest map we've ever done for a starship. It's 70 inches long and 24 inches wide. And there's two sheets of this, the upper deck and the lower deck. That's your home dinner table. If you've got, you know, kind of a standard size, maybe 6 feet long dinner table, that's the whole thing. Mm-hmm. You know, people have their character sheets and their dice and everything pulled off to the side, and the map covers everything. Mm-hmm. So if you've got a longer table for a convention or something, or you've pushed some tables together, maybe that's pretty big. But you know, WotC has that the Falling Star, the big 27-inch long wooden sailing ship, you know, plastic model that they have, and it's a great model. It's 27 inches. It's probably fantastic for con play or something where you want people to see it and say, oh, wow, that's a nice display. But if you put two of those with any distance on them, you've taken up the table. You know, so there is a limit to the size of ships. We're never going to see the end of Dead Suns. They've got a fleet of colossal warships moving around. Yes. And Owen created the rules for super colossal ships that are kilometers long. We're never going to see any of that laid out on a table somewhere. Matt built me a 750 feet wide orbiting circular space station that you're only ever going to see slices of at a time.
Right.
Because you don't have anywhere to put it. And I think that's probably been a problem forever. As a kid, I used to play the Marvel Superheroes game, and they had blocks and blocks, city blocks of the New York City street map. And that's your living room all laid out somewhere if you wanted to play that. And I don't know who has that kind of space anymore.
Yeah, so it sounds like you've kind of tried to find niches, especially in Starfinder, for maps and cartography and whatnot. Have you expanded into other areas? You were building this initial kind of world, right? Has that come to fruition?
So we are working on the campaign guide. Jim will poke me probably once a quarter when the Qatar guide will come out. And it's basically a species guide to our lion men, if you were to get very Flash Gordon about it. They're kind of bigger than a Patra. They're you know, a walking grizzly bear sized.
So they're large size then.
Well, I kept them medium because I wasn't so familiar with, you know, the whole idea of we're going to have a bunch of largest walking around. And I've heard people's actual plays where they had the big full size bear. And, you know, crawling through tubes and tunnels and stuff. And the
yes, it can be issues.
Yes. One of the guys on, I want to say Critical Hit was Cosmic Crit. That's what it was.
Yeah.
Cosmic Crit was squeezing all the time in a combat and hardly got anything done because he was still squeezing. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, the bears can be a problem. But so I kept these guys size medium. They do eventually get to large because they're very fond of power armor, which, again, the guys at Paizo solved for me by having power armor built into Starfinder, and I didn't have to invent it. So we were looking at power armor. We were looking at mechs. I've done a lot of speculation of different genres that we could try to emulate, and a lot of them come down to the vehicle rules just, you know, didn't support anything going fast enough, didn't support the kind of customization of things we want. But Tech Revolution is solving that for me. And I didn't expect the vehicle rules in Tech Revolution.
Yeah,
they weren't really talked up early on. So I played around a lot with the mecha rules, and Jim and I actually met through a mecha game back in the 90s, early 2000s. Mm-hmm. So Evil Robot has a mecha history. It's in our blood. We will be doing mecha products. And so that is stuff that's forthcoming. Jim and I are trying to hash out how to beat the Tech Revolution Starfinder mecha rules into Pathfinder 2.
Oh, interesting.
because he wants to do something a little more Vision of Escaflown, Magic Knight Ray Earth, basically. Mm-hmm. You've got a grown mecha type symbiote where the pilot sits kind of in the chest and, you know, wiggles his arms around, and the robot does the same and wears this medieval looking armor and runs around with a sword and beats on things. And so there's a lot of that kind of medieval fantasy mecha in Japanese animation. And, he wants to try to work on that. So we're, first project is see how we convert the weapon proficiencies and base attack bonuses and things that they have in the tech revolution over to a proficiency of piloting and a proficiency of mecha as armor class in Pathfinder 2. And then take all of the weapon damage types that are given out in Tech Revolution and map that over to basic weapon damage and runes, potency runes and things that they have in Pathfinder 2. So there's a little bit of a conversion that's got to be going on to make sure that the math still works and that we don't make something that's too powerful. I know John Compton says the mecha are supposed to be three levels higher than the average party level.
Right, something
that would be a really challenging fight should be something they should be able to do in their mecha as a normal fight. And I want to make sure that the conversion still stands if we move it over to Pathfinder 2 and give people these giant construct kind of creatures they can crawl into and do their rock'em sock'em robots thing. So there's that.
Wow.
And then he wants the whole thing arted in a Japanese style. So
sounds expensive.
well, there's that. And yeah, I've got to pool from a very different set of artists than the ones I've had working on the project so far. We only have a little bit of manga art compared to the more Western style stuff that we've been using so far. Challenges, they make you help you grow. And so we'll see how long it takes us to get that out the door. But again, abusing the mecha system into Pathfinder 2 is the first part of the challenge of that, making something that is, fun and or engaging, to the players. And then, you know, once we've hashed out how it's going to work, the art part, you know, can be collected a little bit later. So,
you know, recently Paizo announced this Pathfinder Infinite and Starfinder Infinite program. So how would these things kind of affect you as a third-party publisher? Kind of what's your thoughts on that?
So I know that a few other publishers and I have been talking about these things, you know, that everybody's got some kind of an idea. And if you're familiar with any of the other community programs, there are differences that Paizo has done things that are better for us as artists to contribute to this community content type program. But at its basic level, it does what the other community content programs do. It lets you play with their IP, to play in their world, and write content that is familiar to the fans of the setting. And so long as you're using their rules. So if you want to write for Pathfinder 1, if you want to write for Pathfinder 2, if you want to write for Starfinder, you can write in Galarian, in the Pact Worlds, using those characters and settings, and create adventures, create supplements, create, you know, different things that fit in those worlds. And you don't have to call the Vesk the Lizardmen. You don't have to call Akaton the Big Red Planet. You can use the real brand names, and you don't have to feel like you've got to make everything generic and flavorless. And so that's one point on the creative side. So if I wanted to have a Mad Max post-apocalyptic chase across a red desert, I can call it Akaton, and I can have the where Akaton used to have all of the mining and factories and things on it, and it's sort of all broken down since the drift. I can populate that world with flavorful scavengers and people who are still just hanging on the bare threads of what used to be a thriving boom-bust economy. If I want to have a big kaiju fight, there's a planet in the Pact Worlds that have kaiju and mecha that are supposed to be sized appropriately to fight them, to help defend the people that live there from them. And I don't have to genericize that as, robot versus big monster. I can plant them on the world, have the kaiju that have already been established there in some of the society play and in the Pack Worlds book, and now with Tech Revolution, take mecha that are in Tech Revolution or make some of my own and create a scenario or setting that fits into that and say, okay, a big monster attacks the village that your, you know, players happen to be at dropping off some supplies or something, and the local militia is looking for somebody that's got a good piloting to jump into this 5-seat robot that fits all of your players, and all of you can jump into your stations and power it up and go fight the big monster and try to save the town. And I don't have to invent anything that isn't already in the setting to do that, because it all exists, and people who've wanted that experience, they've got Tech Revolution in their hands. They've had the one kaiju adventure in Starfinder Society that existed. They want to follow up on that. They want to give that a try. You know, I can write that up, and they can go off and play that adventure.
So it sounds like for stories and adventures that this is great, but do you think then for new character options, new items, new class features and things, that's still better off doing as a third party publisher separate from this? Or is that something that you would put in there as well?
I think if I wanted to put those things in there and have them be a part of the Pact Worlds, if the Pact Worlds themselves contributed something to if you tied the mechanics to the setting in such a way as that the flavor of being in the Pact Worlds were impactful, then yeah, I'd definitely make it part of this project. You're still going to run into the traditional resistances of folks that only want things they can play in society. Those are not going to be probably the community, the people that are going to run there looking for third-party content that now is flavored with Galarian or Pact World sauce. They have fiction built into the license, though. So if you wanted to write some in-world fiction and people were looking for that, that doesn't affect whether they can play it in society. They can go look at the fiction and enjoy themselves. But if they're looking for something they can add to their Pathfinder Society or Starfinder Society character, they probably can't pick the fruit off the third-party tree still, even with the community project, unless we get a whole lot more trust going with Paizo. I've got a book that I wrote called Battle Gloves, and the whole concept of the thing was, if you took at first level the soldier ability to always have an item level battle glove as part of your heavier powered armor, well, there's a set of battle gloves for 100 credits at level 1. The next battle glove you can get is at level 10. There's nothing in between. So if you spend 100 credits to buy the battle gloves, you're better off than taking that class feature. Because you're never going to have anything level appropriate until level 10, and that seems like a waste of a class feature. And so Owen came up with a bunch of weapon charts that help you build a cost and damage per level for basic, advanced, energy weapon, non-energy weapon tables for all 20, maybe 22 levels of item levels that you could use in your game, and they're all balanced against the books from Core and the Weapons and Armory. And so I wrote up 20 item levels worth of battle gloves, so that if you're a soldier and you took that class feature, you could have that. And when Armory came out, there weren't any more battle gloves. They're still only the ones from Core. Mm. So if I'm a soldier and I'm stuck with only first party Paizo content, that class feature really isn't really worth it to me. But if you can convince your GM to take a look at this third party product, I did lay out where all the damage comes from, where all the weapon costing comes from. If they wanted to go buy a fifth level battle glove, this is what it would cost them to buy it instead of just having it as their class feature. And then I compared it to the unarmed strike feat, damage over time. Mm-hmm. And there's early on, the battle glove is a little more powerful. Later on, the unarmed strike's a little bit more powerful, but they all track pretty well. Mm-hmm. So if your GM wanted to take that, look at it, say, is this going to break my game? I really don't think it's going to break their game. What it is filling in a hole that somebody said, I've got a class feature that scales with level, and it's dependent on something written in the equipment chapter, written by another writer, or edited for length and content by an editor. Mm-hmm. And the class feature was not well supported by the equipment chapter.
Right. That sounds like a developer miss there, actually. So.
Right. And so I was hoping to fill that in. Owen said, you know, with this blog post that I made, you could do this thing. Mm-hmm. And a few months later, Owen had still never actually made a book out of it. And I'm like, well, can't wait forever. Somebody needs to write that book. And so I bought a little piece of stock art that looked appropriate. I put it in our standard trade dress. I did out the charts for the cost and the damage, and developed this little 4 or 5 page gizmo and put it up on DriveThru for people that want to have a soldier with a battle glove. Mm-hmm. And want it to scale all 20 levels. So I did the same thing with operatives, because there weren't enough scaled knives and other operative weapons. Mm-hmm. We got a lot more of them in Armory and invented new ones in Armory, but there were still some weird missing ones. Mm-hmm. We didn't have collapsible batons, but we had switchblades over the regular knives.
Yeah, that's kind of crazy not to have an expandable. I mean, we have those now, right? Yes, now. So why wouldn't they have that in the future and be even cooler, right?
Right. So I made 20 levels of collapsible batons and 20 levels of the switchblade and the regular knife. And, you know, they all have the vibro and the dimensional rift edge, molecular rift edge, and all of mm-hmm. those things created at all the different levels. And it looked like there were some where Paizo may have missed and mm-hmm. assigned something the damage from the wrong table into right. there. So I mentioned that this weapon at this level should actually do XYZ damage. You know, use that in your own game as you see fit, but it probably should be errated somewhere if they ever take a look. But I would love to see at some point in the future a listing of society legal stuff that is curated between Paizo and third-party developers.
That would be amazing. That would be cool, like to kind of form a community committee for vetting that, you know?
Yeah.
Because organized play is not run by Paizo. I mean, technically, right? It's separate. It's run by the Organized Play Foundation. So if the foundation, those people, the venture captains, RVCs, said this is how we're going to do stuff, that's how it would be done. But right now, it still kind of seems like it's under the full Paizo direction now. But it seems like it should be able to do this sort of thing. I do have a question for you. What's your sense of the, especially in Starfinder, the overall player base that does society versus that does home games or APs or, you know, non-society stuff? Does it seem like a fairly equal split? Or is it more skewed towards one or the other?
I have to assume that, I mean, there's probably, you know, tons of people that play society, but I have to assume the home game, people running the AP, people running their own home settings or homebrew, or just running something off the cuff using the setting, but not necessarily playing APs. I have to assume those numbers are larger. just people playing in their dining rooms, living rooms, you know, what have you, or across the planet on some virtual tabletop, have to be larger than the society play. I started when COVID started playing with some folks in the Midwest, thousands of miles away from me, but we had a grand old time playing with. They were a virtual offshoot of a local game store's meetup group, but they were kind enough to take some out-of-towners in. I don't know if you know Hillary Moon Murphy.
Oh yeah, I know Hillary.
So she was offered some folks in the Starfinder Facebook group, you know, come over to our table, and she, you know, was running games every other week or something before a whole lot of freelancing commitments hit her. And so I got to play a number of games with her as the GM, and got my character up to fourth level or so before real life hit me pretty hard, and I dropped out of organized play for a little while. I do want to get back in the swing of that. Regular Starfinder game feels good, and for everybody out there who's got the game and has never played, you gotta really look at the Warhorn and the meetup and the other places where they gather, and try and find yourself a table. Even if you can't find one locally, try to find one online. Mm-hmm.
So what advice do you have for people interested in breaking into freelancing? For example, if they would if they're interested in freelancing for Evil Robot Games, for example.
So for us, I know that every blog post I write has my email at the bottom. I hang out in the Starfinder RPG group. I'm in the Pathfinder and Pathfinder 2 Facebook groups. So, you know, my email's available. I'm usually in just Paul Fields on Facebook, in any of the Paizo third party or the Paizo fans groups. So if they want to just hit me up there, email's probably the easiest, but Facebook Messenger and other things work as well. We can certainly talk about things, talk about people's credits, talk about where to point them to. We ran an open call to design a bunch of gear before Starfinder came out. So we were still using sort of the Iron Gods version of technology, how it was sort of still Pathfinderized, and a hybrid version of a lot of things that had been written for the original RPG Superstar on how to write a magic item. And we had invalidated a couple of the judges' rules about your weird item shouldn't emulate technology too bad. And I said, well, we're a sci-fi setting. I think we can bend that one rule. If you want a sci-fi toaster, you can make a sci-fi toaster because it's a sci-fi fantasy game. Mm-hmm. So we did that. And as an open call, it was pretty raw. We tried to limit things down to things that were in a sensor and vision sphere. So goggles and torches and, you know, flashlights and different things. And we got some weird stuff in that way. And there was a lot of editing involved. There's a lot of working back and forth and trying to decide if, you know, some item somebody's got their heart set on just really doesn't fit the setting, or you know, is it mechanically broken? Is it thematically just wrong? So I can only now sympathize with what the RPG Superstar folks had to deal with back in the day on an open call. We have a post up, and I think it was for last year, 2020, the punch list of work. And it's an editable WordPress file, and it's got a list of projects that we want to work on. And this thing needs to be written. This thing needs a map. This thing needs 15 pieces of art, you know, and they're all there with stages of has the art direction been written? Has the art order been written? Has a sketch been received? Has it, you know, the sketch has been approved? Has it gotten colored? Has it been paid for? And it works, you know, from left to right as a project management plan. But if somebody wanted to look at things that we were already sort of planning and put out there for the world, things that we're looking for artists and writers to do, then that would be a place to start. Another place to start is we do have a webpage. Well, we have a webpage, we have a Facebook page, we have a Twitter. We talk to artists periodically on Twitter that will send me a link to their galleries. And whether it's on ArtStation or DeviantArt or wherever you've got your art hanging out, if you want to work for somebody, have yourself a gallery. Have an example of some work that you can show, even if it's something that hasn't been published, but something you did for your homebrew or something you wanted to emulate from a favorite TV series of yours or whatever, and you put it up online someplace. Have it where people can see it. Point people to it. Maybe they can critique it and help you get better and help your next thing be better, but also that gives something to me as the art director or as the publisher, that if I want to take you on for a project, I have some sample of what I'm looking for. Now, you'll run into people who say, oh, I've got all these credits and I've done all this work, and all of it is still being published and it's still behind an NDA and they can't show you any of it. And so you don't have any idea what the quality of the work is until it comes out the other end and it's been edited and touched. And, you know, so if you've got something that you've done just as a concept to put out there, sort of a shadow portfolio kind of a thing, things that never got used, things that never got picked up, that might not be the greatest way to sell to somebody else, but at least it shows that you know how the mechanics work. It knows how, you know, how to fill out a stat block, how, you know, in Pathfinder 1, we used to have 15 different bonus types, the, you know, the weapon, the dodge, the enhancement, the circumstance, the alchemical, all of these crazy things. In Pathfinder or Starfinder, there's 4. And so you've got bonuses that are pretty much exclusive to the envoy. You've got things that pretty much always go to item types. You've got pretty much things that are always associated with a class feature. And what they want to do is make sure that you can still have your item, you can still have your class feature, the envoy can still give you some kind of a bonus, and those things will stack, but you won't end up with the crazy unlimited bonus stacking that you had in Pathfinder 1. Alex Agunos did a fantastic write-up of how the bonus types were supposed to work when Starfinder first came out. That's a good place to kind of look when you're building things, to make sure that you're not, you know, you made a fizzy pop drink that you drink the serum and it gives you a bonus that's supposed to belong to an envoy, and now the envoy can't do anything to you because you've already got a bonus that's, you know, blocking his class abilities. Right. And so those are the things that you'd want to see and know that somebody can handle all that. And it's not really very explicitly stated that way in the core rules. And so one of the weirdest, best things we could do as an industry is have the core rules, setting guides, whatever you want to call them, be how the players play. But we don't have developer content that programmers would have, you know, like an API or something where they would go look and say, this is how we're supposed to develop things that people can play on the play side and that they would work smoothly in the game and not break the game because we know how the things are supposed to be built to work together. There's not as much developer content, although if you look at the core rules with a critical eye, you can figure it out. But again, to people trying to get in, it's hard to necessarily know why those choices and decisions were made. So whenever I find that stuff, combing over podcasts from the network, going over interviews with the main designers, I try to scribble down as many of those things as I can on the website to help people figure out the difference between Pathfinder 1 and Starfinder, the differences between Starfinder and Pathfinder 2, and what they've done to balance and what our products should try to incorporate and what mistakes we should probably not make along the way. So,
yeah, so I noticed on your webpage, so evilrobotgames.com, under category publishing, there is a updated ERG 2020 punch list of work items to be assigned. So that's a good starting point if somebody wants to look at that and say, hey, I can do that, to hit you up via email and kind of start talking about it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I have to get around to updating it for 2021 or 2022 here shortly. But that was, I thought, kind of an easy way to put that out there. Mm-hmm. One, so that my collaborators and I kind of knew, you know, kept our eye on the ball, and we weren't keeping things in email or keeping things scribbled in notes on our desk or whatever, put them all somewhere everybody could see that. And that any freelancers that wanted to come along and say, hey, I've got this idea for a thing that's completely not associated with your property or with Paizo's, and I want you to publish for me. Those don't always go over so well. Not just with me. I know there's other publishers that are willing to talk about anything because, you know, you might have the next big thing for real. Mm-hmm. But a lot of publishers are busy with their own ideas, and so sometimes you want to start off with something they already wanted to do and were already looking to pay somebody for. And if you can, you know, navigate that with something that you can find interesting and they want to make a book and sell, mm-hmm. You know, that's a not bad place. But if I can take my list of things that I want to do and put them out there in a public sphere where people can look at it and say, hey, I want to, you know, hang on to that or try and be a part of that, then I feel like that is a little bit easier. And some of those things, you know, we'll eventually backfill with other writers and artists if we get around to putting the spotlight on a book that has to go out next. But if it's sitting and nobody's tasked or assigned to it, then yeah, send me an email. If you've got something that you feel like is up our alley, go ahead and send me an email anyways, or see if, you know, anything's going on that maybe didn't make it on the list. That is something that we've just been kicking the ball around and haven't gotten to updating the webpage yet. Might have something that's not there or that we aren't ready to talk about yet. But if we find the right writer to collaborate with, or the right artist to collaborate with, it might happen. So yeah, now that's a good starting point, but a cold email out of nowhere isn't terrible. The worst thing anybody can ever say is no.
All right, so Paul, what's next for Evil Robot Games? What's something cool you're working on that you can talk about?
So Jim Milligan, he's one of my collaborators. He's been writing a cyberpunk game for a long time. He's been writing novels in the cyberpunk genre for a long time, and he's working on an in-house system. It's 2d6 plus stat plus skill. It's the same system we used for our wizard school game, I Want to Be a Wizard, which is a rules light game for people that want to have a certain wizard school experience, not necessarily a Harry Potter experience. Mm-hmm. We developed it generically enough that you could roll your own magic school, give it your own flavor. We wanted people to be able to play the magicians or something like a Harry Potter or something not like it, either one of them at all. Mm-hmm. And that you could put together your characters fairly quickly, and they could go on adventures and do things. And we created the school headmaster's guide for running it, which was just answered sort of some of the basic questions about running the very rules light early game. And Jim is developing that into an OGL licensed fuller system for his Cyberpunk game. And along the way, we're going to try to release some smaller games. I'm changing I Want to Be a Wizard into one called I Want to Survive, and it's a zombie survival horror game.
Oh, cool.
Right. So we want to do that. I have a couple of other things that will be Starfinder-based that we were also going to use zombie survival horror. We're going to do a Wild West supplement. Just saw that Guns and Gears got pushed another month. Which is terrible for my Wild West steampunk ideas, releasing something that is more in an 1800s flavor using Starfinder rules. I want to say Luis has been running a game that way for a while using Pathfinder 2, and I know that Owen has his Wild Weird West, and I'm working on my Golden Age of Steam is the name we gave it, and we want it to have both Western and Victorian England flavors. Hmm. Probably the furthest thing along for that is a mummy chase across merry old London town. Hmm. And there's mummies just waking up all over England. And the players have to figure out why that's happening and how to stop it. And there's a lot of mummies in London in the 1800s, not just sitting out in the museum, but they were shipped there for medicinal purposes and all kinds of other things, for medical students to practice on. There were just a lot of mummies in London in the 1800s. So I thought we could capitalize on that with a little Egyptian necromancy, and see what our daring group of investigators and, you know, layabout steampunk characters would do with something like that. So we're building that. Again, we got the Wild West, which we're going to do some interesting things to as we fill out the steampunk rules a little bit more. I have a lot of naval warfare Age of Sail stuff I'd like to do, and we're trying to pin down the right cartographer to do old wooden ships, and so that we can release a lot of those. If you look at the history of first edition Dungeons and Dragons, there were like five or six ships that Gary put in the DMG. Second edition didn't add many more. Third edition didn't add any more. Fourth edition, it didn't add anymore. So you had a keelboat, a longboat, a rowboat, a galley. That was pretty much it. And the sailing ship. Well, a sailing ship, very generically, Skull and Shackles added like two more boats or ships, you know, proper. And still, everything breaks down to the sailing ship being the main part of that. And we will probably never release, cartographers and I have talked about this, probably never release anything larger than a third-rate 74-gun ship of the line from Napoleonic era, because at that point you're almost 200 feet long and you're, again, taking up somebody's entire dinner table. But smaller ships, fifth and sixth rates, you know, 60 to 100 feet long, Zebeks and sloops of war and different things that pirates ran around in, were much faster and more maneuverable and don't take up quite as much space on your dinner table. And I think there's a lot of room to do that. And I also wanted to introduce some Asian ships. Chinese ships are entirely different from Japanese ships, are entirely different from Korean ships. The Koreans would build these great big barges and build wooden palisades and forts on them, and they would attack you with siege weapons. The Japanese would build these ships that they would run up to you and board you as quickly as possible, and their naval strategy was to engage you in melee combat by boarding your ship as quickly as they could, and there wasn't a lot of siege weaponry in the Japanese style. But they had, you know, all of these different ships. The Chinese had these treasure ships they ran. again, the Koreans had these floating forts. The Japanese had their different kinds of ships, and they're nothing at all like Mediterranean road galleys, which were their own kind of warfare, or triremes, or any of the things that happened in the Mediterranean. The Mediterranean is a very calm set of waters, but you get to the Atlantic, you can't use a Mediterranean ship in the Atlantic. It'll fall over and sink.
Yeah, that low freeboard's going to get you.
Right. And so that's the kind of thing that we want to introduce in a world of varied geography, but also just varied cultures. You're going to have a lot more than five basic ships. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to try and do something kind of like the vehicle rules in Tech Revolution, and kind of like the Stronghold Builder's Guide from 3.5. Mm-hmm. Which will let you say, I've got a 5 foot square here. What can I put there? I'm going to put the powder room, or I'm going to put the captain's quarters, or I'm going to put, you know, all of these little things that go into my ship that make my ship different from everybody else's ship. But again, I need the right cartographer, and we're going to start working from British Museum copies of blueprints, from the French Admiral Paris, who ran the French Museum for a long, long time, did hundreds of sketches, and these enormous books of his and these book plates have traditional Asian and other ships from all around the world that he studied during his time, and drafted out the plans for all of these gorgeous ships. He's got a very nice Zebek and Zebek, the Barbary pirates used. Mm-hmm. It was a very, very fast and nimble ship that could sail very close to the wind and outrun obviously any fat merchantman, but even a lot of the naval military vessels. It was very fast. And so these are the kinds of things I'd like to see in a system whose history going back 40 years hasn't really gone very far beyond those five basic ships. And when they did, it was, oh, we've got an elven longboat that's really pretty, or we've got a stone dwarven boat that somehow floats or something, you know, and the really weird goblin ship. I have an art request out to one of my artists that I want her to build me a flying whale with a trade ship, the pieces of a crashed trade ship sort of strapped to it, and a halfling crew running around hanging off the side in buckets and, you know, pulling barnacles and things off of the whale. And the whale's taking them all around the world, and they're trading and seeing things and exploring, but they're also taking care of the whale as they do it. And I want the halfling crew to kind of be an homage to the Time Bandits.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we don't have any sketches back from that one yet, but she was very excited by the concept. So we'll see where that goes. But I wanted, there is in Pathfinder 2, one airship. There is not an air rowboat. There is not an air longboat or keelboat or anything. There is one airship. And so I want to spread that out and kind of have, this is what a dirty, smoky, gas-burning goblin airship would look like. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is what maybe the elven pretty airship would look like, and give it a little more spread. And I want to say the item level on the typical Pathfinder 2 airship is like a 12. Hmm. And I know one of the things when we Pathfinder 2 first came out, the campaign setting that we put out is about a broken clockwork world with airships. And Jim wanted people flying at level 3. Campaign starts at level 3. You get a little bit of your racial abilities. You get a little bit of your character class abilities under your belt. And you start in a world where airships are commonplace. And so we wanted to have some smaller item level rowboats and keelboats and things that get bigger until you finally do get that full-size airship.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not like you have to wait until level 12 for the campaign to really begin.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So trying to add a little bit more of that and more flavor. Again, like I said, if you remember the smokers from Waterworld.
Yep. Yep.
You know, again, going back to sort of the post-apocalyptic thing, I want to see what a goblin airship would look like outside of World of Warcraft. So.
Well, it sounds like you have a lot of stuff going on. It's looking forward to seeing some of this coming out.
Well, I am too. But again, it just the writers and the artists have to hit at the right time, you know, while we're pushing on something. And COVID has put more people at home, and you know, it's people have had time for projects, but you know, a lot of people are also just taking care of themselves and trying to get through it. So. Mm-hmm. Our release schedule has not been what it could have been if there weren't a worldwide pandemic.
No, it's affected a lot of folks. So, well, Paul, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast today.
No problem.